Chapter 16. Writing. First, picture writing. Second, syllable writing. Third, alphabet writing. Fourth, the place of writing in human life. In the four preceding chapters, chapters 12 to 15, we've sketched in broad outline the development of the chief human communities from the primitive beginnings of the Heliolithic culture to the great historical kingdoms and empires in the 6th century BC. We must now study a little more closely the general process of social change, the growth of human ideas, and the elaboration of human relationships that was going on during these ages between 10,000 BC and 500 BC. What we've done so far is to draw the map and name the chief kings and empires, to define the relations in time and space of Babylonia, Assyria, Egypt, Phoenicia, Knossos, and the like. We come now to the real business of history, which is to get down below these outer forms to the thoughts and lives of individual men. By far the most important thing that was going on during those 50 or 60 centuries of social development was the invention of writing and its gradual progress to importance in human affairs. It was a new instrument for the human mind, an enormous enlargement of its range of action, a new means of continuity. We've seen how in later Paleolithic and early Neolithic times, the elaboration of articulate speech gave men a mental handhold for consecutive thought and a vast enlargement of their powers of cooperation. For a time, this new acquirement seems to have overshadowed their earlier achievement of drawing, and possibly it checked the use of gesture. But drawing presently reappeared again for record, for signs, for the joy of drawing. Before real writing came picture writing, such as is still practiced by the Amerindians, the Bushmen, and savage and barbaric people in all parts of the world. It's essentially a drawing of things and acts helped out by heraldic indications of proper names and by strokes and dots to represent days and distances and such like quantitative ideas. Quite kindred to such picture writing is the pictograph that one finds still in use today in international railway timetables upon the continent of Europe, where a little black sign of a cup indicates a stand-up buffet for light refreshments, a crossed knife and fork, a restaurant, a little steamboat, a transfer to a steamboat, and a postillion's horn, a diligence. Similar signs are used in the well-known Michelin guides for automobilists in Europe to show a post office envelope or a telephone receiver. The quality of hotels is shown by an inn with one, two, three, or four gables, and so forth. Similarly, the roads of Europe are marked with wayside signs representing a gate to indicate a level crossing ahead, a sinuous bend for a dangerous curve, and the like. From such pictographic signs to the first elements of Chinese writing isn't a very long stretch. In Chinese writing, there are still traceable a number of pictographs. Most are now difficult to recognize. A mouth was originally written as a mouth-shaped hole and is now, for convenience of brushwork, squared. A child, originally a recognizable little mannequin, is now a hasty wriggle and a cross. The sun, originally a large circle with a dot in the center, has been converted, for the sake of convenience, of combination, into a crossed oblong, which is easier to make with a brush. By combining these pictographs, a second order of ideas is expressed. For example, the pictograph for mouth, combined with the pictograph for vapor, expressed words. From such combinations, one passes to what are called ideograms. The sign for words and the sign for tongue combine to make speech. The sign for roof and the sign for pig make home, for in the early domestic economy of China, the pig was as important as it used to be in Ireland. But as we have already noted earlier, the Chinese language consists of a comparatively few elementary monosyllabic sounds which are all used in a great variety of meanings, and the Chinese soon discovered that a number of these pictographs and ideographs could be used also to express other ideas not so conveniently pictured but having the same sound. Characters so used are called phonograms. For example, the sound fang meant not only boat, but a place, spinning, fragrant, inquire, and several other meanings according to the context. But while a boat is easy to draw, most of the other meanings are undrawable. How can one draw fragrant or inquire? The Chinese, therefore, took the same sign for all these meanings of fang, but added to each of them another distinctive sign, the determinative, to show what sort of fang was intended. A place was indicated by the same sign as for boat, fang, and the determinative sign for earth, spinning by the sign for fang and the sign for silk, inquire by the sign for fang and the sign for words, and so on. One may perhaps make this development of pictographs, ideograms, and phonograms a little clearer by taking an analogous case in English. Suppose we were making a sort of picture writing in English, then it would be very natural to use a square with a slanting line to suggest a lid for the word and thing box. That would be a pictograph. But now suppose we had a round sign for money, and suppose we put this sign inside the box sign. That would do for cash box or treasury. That would be an ideogram. But the word box is used for other things than boxes. There's the box shrub, which gives us box wood. It would be hard to draw a recognizable box tree distinct from other trees, but it is quite easy to put our sign box and add our sign for shrub as a determinative to determine that it is that sort of box and not a common box that we want to express. And then there's box the verb, meaning to fight with fists. Here again, we need a determinative. We might add the two crossed swords, a sign which is used very often upon maps, to denote a battle. A box at a theatre needs yet another determinative, and so we go on through a long list of phonograms. Now it's manifest that here in the Chinese writing is a very peculiar and very complex system of sign writing. A very great number of characters have to be learnt and the mind habituated to their use. The power it possesses to carry ideas and discussion is still ungauged by Western standards, but we may doubt whether with this instrument it will ever be possible to establish such a wide common mentality as the simpler and swifter alphabets of the Western civilizations permit. In China, it created a special reading class, the mandarins, who were also the ruling and official class. Their necessary concentration upon words and classical forms rather than upon ideas and realities seems, in spite of her comparative peacefulness and the very high individual intellectual quality of her people, to have greatly hampered the social and economic development of China. Probably it's the complexity of her speech and writing more than any other imaginable cause that has made China today, politically, socially, and individually, a vast pool of backward people rather than the foremost power in the whole world. Second, but while the Chinese mind thus made for itself an instrument which is probably too elaborate in structure, too laborious in use, and too inflexible in its form to meet the modern need for simple, swift, exact, and lucid communications, the growing civilizations of the West were working out the problem of a written record upon rather different and, on the whole, more advantageous lines. They didn't seek to improve their script to make it swift and easy, but circumstances conspired to make it so. The Sumerian picture writing, which had to be done upon clay and with little stiles, which made curved marks with difficulty and inaccurately, rapidly degenerated by a conventionalized dabbing down of wedge-shaped marks, cuneiform, which means wedge-shaped, into almost unrecognizable hints of the shapes intended. It helped the Sumerians greatly to learn to write that they had to draw so badly.